This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Right, can you... I have a very low voice. Can you hear me at the back? Yeah. Okay, thanks for coming. Just one quick point before we start is I may say some things which people disagree with. I may use figures that you want to question. I'd be grateful if you could keep your any issues you want to raise till the Q&A at the end rather than starting to throw things while I'm talking. Okay, let me start with a problem. We have about £4 trillion in Britain in various financial products, those sorts of things listed there. We're paying the people who've convinced us to put our money into all these schemes and who are running the schemes for us around £1 million a minute, £400 million every working day, about £100 billion a year. Now, it would be okay to be paying that amount of money if the investments sold to us by our banks were shooting up in value, if our unit trusts were giving the mouth-watering returns that we see in the unit trust ads, if our pensions were growing healthily, and if we were all going to retire on big fat annuities. But sadly, for the majority of people in the country, the last 10, 15 years, in terms of their savings, have been a catastrophe. Now, that will not be the case for the people in this room. I understand that. But there's probably only a couple of 100,000 people in the country, I don't know, probably less than 1% who actually have the same degree of financial literacy that you do. The level of financial literacy amongst the population, and even amongst those who've got lots of money in savings and pensions and things, is appallingly low. Now, just to give one very simple example, you've probably seen it. A survey done found that only 9% of the electorate understood that if the country had a deficit, the debt went up. 60% thought if the deficit went down, the debt goes down. Now, you probably say, well, that most of our politicians don't understand it either, which, and especially not most of our chancellors. So there is a really serious problem there of financial illiteracy. Now, what I want to do tonight, I want to go through the main sorts of places where people would put this £4 trillion, and I want to propose that the sales arguments that are used to convince them to put their money into all these schemes are absolutely logical, are incredibly plausible, but are at the same time highly misleading, often based on blatant lies, and almost always, in fact, definitely always, in the interest of the financial services industry and absolutely not in the interest of the customers. Now, before I launch into my piece, I'm not an economist, and I have never worked in financial services. And when I saw the list of people coming here tonight, I felt a sense of terror at what's going to happen during the Q&A session. So please, be gentle. My background is management consulting. I spent most of my working life selling consultancy projects and to government departments and to big companies all around Europe. After many years in the game, I became a bit disillusioned how the whole thing was developing, and I wrote a couple of whistleblowing books. The one on the left, where I look at how consultancies take many millions out of private companies and often don't exactly deliver a lot in return, and the one on the other side, on the right, where I looked at New Labour's £70 billion infatuation with their famous management consultants as they transformed our public sector. Now, you can probably guess that this was the end of my career as an international, very important management consultant. But I carried on. I wrote a few other books, mainly about current affairs and stuff. I wrote one, Squandered, which I think was the first time that somebody said that Gordon Brown was a financially incontinent lying buffoon. I did one in the European Union, one in the NHS, fleeced on the financial crash. And most recently, I did Greed Unlimited, about what's happening under the coalition. Now, while I was busy scribbling away and annoying pretty much everybody I came into contact with, I happened to be in the branch of Barclays Bank one day. And I was upstairs on the first floor, you know, where sort of management and administration people sit. And I was seeing the manager because I was putting some money in a two-year fixed interest account. And while I was there, I heard two young guys up there laughing and joking and having a whale of a time. So as one does, I listened to the conversation. And it turned out these two young guys were financial advisors, Barclays financial advisors. And one of them had just been rung up by a class customer, it was a pensioner, and this financial advisor had convinced the pensioner to put virtually all his life savings into just one fund. And I think they were talking about over £100,000. And sadly, this fund had lost half its value. So the pensioner was obviously feeling slightly grumpy and had rung up to find out what was going on. Anyway, these two young guys thought this was an incredible hoot, but they were also worried that the pensioner was going to make a complaint. And so they were trying to cobble together some excuse to fob him off so that there wasn't a formal complaint made about the financial advice he was given. So that got me thinking. I didn't know anything about money and savings and pensions, all that sort of stuff, but it got me thinking it would be interesting to have a bit of a dig around. So I went to presentations by wealth management companies, St. James's Place, Barclays Wealth, Fisher Investments, those sorts of people. I went to seminars on how to get rich by spread betting and foreign exchange and building my own property empire. I met a lot of financial advisors, both working for banks and independent ones. And that led to me writing, as you could probably expect, two books. The first one, Pillaged, where I try to look at what's happening to the £4 trillion that people have in savings. And the second one comes out in a few weeks, where not just for financial services, but for a lot of different industries, I look at the sales processes, the arguments used, the psychology used to get ordinary people to hand over their money. So you can probably see by the kind of books that I write what I'm going to say tonight. So let's get going. Number one, banks. For many years, banks have been more than delighted to run our current accounts for us free of charge. Now, I guess they made a bit of money on it. I don't really know. But the main reason for doing it was, of course, to use their knowledge of us and their knowledge of our finances to cross-sell, to sell us other financial products, savings, investments, pensions, insurance, you name it. Now, of course, about 15 years ago, the banks had a brainwave. Say, why are we providing these current accounts free? Let's charge people for them. So they came up with a wonderful idea of the packaged account, where they could sell us a current account with a whole lot of bells and whistles attached, and they could convince people it's a really awfully good idea to pay £150 to £300 a year for your current account, which you can have free, because you get all this extra stuff. Now, obviously, these accounts will be of use to some people, and they'll be good value for some people. But 11 million people are paying for their current accounts. I have a feeling that once all the PPI claims companies have exhausted the gold mine of PPI claims, that like a herd of vultures, I don't know, a flock of vultures, they're all going to move on to the mis-selling of packaged accounts, and we're going to see billions more being repaid. Don't know, just a theory. Anyway, to get back to cross-selling, banks have huge overhead costs, massive branch networks, mainly on high streets, expensive locations, big computer systems, and hugely overpaid managers and executives. So in general, any product sold to you by a bank has to have a huge gross margin in order to pay those costs. So there are exceptions, of course, but in general, anything sold by the bank will either be more expensive or more poorly performing than a similar product sold by somebody with less overhead costs than the bank. Moreover, many of the products sold by banks are actually just originated by somebody else. The banks slap on a commission and sell it to us, so you better to go back to the originating company and buy it. One of the products that banks have been very successful in selling to us are investments. Now, I mentioned the old guy at Barclays who'd lost about half his money. This is pure speculation. What I think happened to him is the following. At the time, Barclays had what they called a strategic partnership with Aviva. There's somebody here from Aviva, by the way, tonight. Anyway, part of the strategic partnership was that there were two funds, two up there, which Aviva were keen to get money in, and they were incentivizing Barclays with big commissions that Barclays would get their customers to put money into these two funds. Now, Aviva, quite honestly, is my understanding, did class both these funds as high risk. But it looks to me like the marketing department of Aviva got hold of these funds, and they gave them nice, friendly, cuddly, seductive titles, the Global Balanced Fund and the Cautious Fund. How a high-risk fund could be cautious is slightly beyond me. It sounds slightly oxymoronic. And anybody here who knows about the Arch Crew scandal will recognize the word balanced and cautious, because the Arch Crew fund, which collapsed with massive losses, was also a balanced, cautious fund. Anyway, Aviva classed these funds as high risk. But then, knowingly or not, we don't know, Barclays financial advisors were really pushing people, mainly pensioners, who were classed as risk-averse, into these funds. And they got about $690 million into these two funds. Now, of course, the end of the story is obvious. The balanced fund wasn't balanced, and the cautious fund wasn't cautious. And one lost 30% of its value and the other lost 50. And the result was, it's the second line there, if you can read it, Barclays got a nice big fine and had to pay some compensation. And I read recently that Barclays, after that, have taken almost all their financial advisors out of their branches, and they now only give financial advice to people with more than £100,000 to invest, because, of course, that's what the FSA or the FCA considers as a sophisticated investor. So anything goes. Now, the investment product the banks seem to be selling a lot of at the moment are the so-called structured products. These come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. But a common one is you get 70 or 80 or 90% of the growth of a certain stock market index, but if the index goes down, you're guaranteed to get your money back in full. You get your capital back. So the selling message is you get the potential of stock market growth without any of the risks. Wonderful story, and it works. About £60 billion, B with a billion, has gone into these funds, into these products. The problem is, I hope everybody has already spotted, is that unless you are a expert in market timing, and most people are not experts in market timing, most people do what we call informationless investing, which means they put money into bonds or shares or pensions when they got the money, rather than when they think the markets are right. Unless you're an expert in market timing, the benefits of being in a stock market come from the dividends and reinvesting the dividends to get the compounding effect. But these products don't buy shares usually. They're based on financial derivatives and they only follow the index. And even if they do buy shares, they don't give the dividends to the investor. So those wonderful words, you get the potential of stock market growth, hide the absolute horror of, but you lose almost all the benefits of being involved in the stock market. And ordinary people do not understand that. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put the $60 billion in, would they? I guess a rule of thumb is anybody who put money in these products when FTSE was around 5.5 will make money. Anybody put it when FTSE is above 6 and a bit is going to be a little bit disappointed. Now, there's a few selling stories around to convince us why we should put money into stock exchanges. One is the sort of, this is the FTSE 100 chart. It's 30 years old this year. And it's, I mean, there've been a bit of bumps on the way, 2000, 2008. But the mental picture this creates in the mind of the average saver is, jeepers, it's a no-brainer. I've got to put money in shares. I mean, only an idiot wouldn't do that. And I remember in the summer of last year, or late summer, the FTSE went to 675 or something like that, and all these financial journalists were wittering on about FTSE heading for new highs and FTSE breaking new records and get on the bandwagon and get in quick, FTSE could hit 7,000 by the end of the year, etc. But of course, it's not really true. Because what most people do not understand is that indexes or indices, I don't know which, like the FTSE, are nominal indexes. They are not adjusted for inflation. And when we adjust this for inflation, which is the blue line, that's the chart that we sent out last week, the picture's still not terrible, but instead of going up by a factor of 6.5 over 30 years, the FTSE has only doubled over the 30 years. But I mean, of course, you still get the dividends and stuff, so it doesn't look too bad. But I find it intensely troubling that journalists repeatedly, I saw three articles on Friday talking about the FTSE going to a new high because, of course, with the Vodafone business in America and all that money coming back, there's going to be a big demand for shares. But it is intensely troubling because in real terms, or inflation-adjusted terms, the FTSE would have to go to over 10,000 to get back to the purchasing power that it had in 1999. And that's not going to happen in my lifetime. So it's incredibly deceptive to be talking about records and record highs. There's another thing happening here which troubles me greatly. What you're actually seeing here is 17 years going up and 13 years going down. Now, there are many reasons why share prices go up and down, obviously. But one thing is happening here which I believe that no financial journalist, no financial advisor, nobody in a bank, nobody who wants to sell you shares will ever mention, which is, of course, the baby boomer effect. The baby boomers were at their maximum earning and savings potential in the 80s and 90s when the stock market went up most. As the baby boomers move to retirement, they're going to move their money from pension schemes into annuities, which are more likely to buy bonds than shares. Also, because they won't have had annuity rates being so low, they won't have as much money to live off as they thought they would, so a lot will be selling shares and unit trusts to fund their living expenses. So there's going to be quite a big withdrawal of money from the market. Now, the American Government Accounting Office has done a study on this, and the figures they came out with, I don't actually remember, but they were quite kind of terrifying. But at the end of the study, they said there's no need to panic. And when a government department tells you not to panic, it's a bit like the captain of the Costa Concordia saying, enjoy your dinner, while he grabs his mistress and heads off to the nearest lifeboat. So there are some things mitigating the baby boomer effect. There's a huge flow of money from the emerging markets because, of course, they had an opposite demographic from us, and they can get companies with reasonable governance to where they can put their money as opposed to slightly wilder local stock markets. And the other thing, of course, is interest rates are so low, a lot of money is moving out of high-interest bank accounts into the market. But if things ever return to normal, whatever that is, and it's difficult to see where demand is going to come from for shares because the next generation, Generation Debt, are going to be so busy paying off mortgages on vastly inflated house prices and student loans that they're not going to be able to do much saving. So something to worry about there. Now, the way that most people invest in the stock exchange is, of course, unit trusts. And around 91% of all money in unit trusts is still in actively managed funds. The sales pitch around actively managed funds is obvious. For just a couple of percent, you get a highly experienced fund manager with loads of researchers to pour through all the company accounts and pick those companies that are going to really perform well, and therefore a unit trust can give much better returns than you could yourself. And you can see by the sales of unit trusts, they were running at about $10 billion a year, say up to about 2008, and then, of course, with low interest rates, absolutely exploded. $30 billion a year. Extraordinary amounts of money pouring out of high-interest bank accounts into unit trusts. Hopefully most people already know what the next panel is going to show. What are the problems? There's far too many unit trusts. There are more unit trusts than there are shares for them to buy. So if you look at the portfolios, the top 10 holdings of many of the unit trusts in any particular market, they're all holding pretty much the same shares. We all know since the loser's game in the 70s, study after study has shown that less than 10% of unit trusts can outperform the market average. So your average punter has a 1 in 10 chance of choosing a unit trust that is going to outperform a tracker. Many unit trusts are closet trackers. We have four times as many closet trackers in the UK than they have in America. But even if you don't put your money in a closet tracker, if you follow the excellent advice to diversify, then you may end up owning shares in so many companies that you have brilliantly but inadvertently created your own closet tracker, but you're still paying active management fees. And finally, unit trusts are an awful lot more expensive than people think they are. You know, an investor will be, you've got the 5% kind of upfront fee. Now, I know you can avoid that if you go through a fund supermarket, but 3/4 of the money going to unit trusts goes through financial advisors, and at least up until the RDR, they would not tell their clients about the fund supermarkets because, of course, they get their upfront commissions from the 5%. What's going to happen after the RDR retail distribution review, I don't know, but I think in the history of regulation, there has never been a regulated company that has not been able to get around the regulation that the regulator is trying to put on it, or something like that. So I think I know how the financial advisors are going to get around the RDR, but we haven't got time for that tonight. Anyway, you've got your 5% going in. Then people will be told the AMC, the annual management charge, is 1.1%, say, 1.2. If the person selling it is more honest, they'll talk about the TER, total expense ratio, averaging about 1.6 in the UK at the moment. Now, to your average saver, if you say the total price of this house is £160,000, they don't expect to pay between £220,000 and £320,000. But that's what they're doing with a unit trust. Wake up, wake up. Oh, the gentleman in the front row. Maybe he's just listening intently. But that's what they're doing with unit trusts. Because, of course, the TER doesn't include a whole load of expenses. There's the trading cost, for example, averaging about 0.6%. So that takes you up to 2.2. And the two reports I've seen say that a unit trust with a 1.6% TER, one report said it was costing 4% a year, and the other report said 3.2% a year. And that is a big difference to be paying, think you're paying 1.6 and actually be paying 3.2. So say you hold a unit trust for 5 years. You've got 5% going in. You've got, say, 2.5% a year in charges. I think it's more, but never mind. So that's 12.5% plus 5, 17.5%. You've got inflation at 2% a year, another 10%, 27.5%. And then you want to make some money above inflation, say 2% a year. It's not a lot to ask. That's another 10%. So your unit trust is going to go up by something like 37 to 40% over 5 years for you to make a modest 2% a year above inflation return. And sadly, gentlemen, ladies, I hate to disappoint you, but most unit trusts are not going to do that. Anyway, if your investments get chewed up by fees on unit trust, the effect on pensions is obviously much, much worse because you're paying the fees over a longer period of time. Now, the pension companies are always doing these... Oh, I don't know how a picture of my wife got in there. Never mind. Anyway, the pension companies are forever doing these surveys where they find that people are not saving enough for retirement. And these are eagerly reported in financial press. And we're told, start early, start saving early. That's what you need to do because the government can't look after your retirement. So, and there's two things wrong with this argument. First of all, we often get shown these wonderful charts where, you know, if you start a few years earlier, your pension pot accumulates into sort of ginormous Bill Gatesian quantities of money. Well, of course, the growth rates used are ludicrously above what anybody's actually going to get. Up until April this year, pension companies have been using the old 5.79%. I think after April, it's 2.58 or 2.558. I'm quite sure I've seen different people say different things. But pension funds have actually been returning, I think, only in the 2 to 3% a year. And I think that's before inflation. And the difference over 30 or 40 years of, say, 3% if you're lucky, and the 5% that your projection is going to, that you're going to focus on, because that's the sort of the middle level of the projections, is absolutely massive. So many people are getting completely deluded impressions about what they're going to have when they finally come to retire. The second thing wrong with this is start early. Yes, like all arguments in financial services, it is logical and it is true that if you start earlier, you will have more money at the end of the day. But the question is it in your interest? if you're paying, say, 2% a year, 1.75 to 2% a year for your pension, the money you put in 40 years before retirement, you're paying 70 to 80% in fees. And then, you know, a little bit. The rule of thumb is about a third of all the money you put into your pension will go in fees, if not more. If you're in an old-fashioned pension, it's probably more. So one could say, yes, you will have more money if you start early, but actually you'd be much better off putting as little as possible into your pension fund, even with the tax advantages and the employer contributions and all that stuff, putting as little as possible in for the first 10, 15, even 20 years of your working life, and instead use your money to pay your mortgage off early. Because if, as long as you don't have early redemption fees, the best, the most lucrative, the most safest, the tax-free saving that anybody will ever make in their life is to repay their mortgage early. And then in the last 10 or 15 years of your life, that's when you should shove money into a pension scheme. Now, the government have been whittling on a bit about controlling the fees that pension funds are going to charge, and it was going to be 0.75% or 1%, and it was going to happen now, and now it's not going to happen, and who knows. And the pensions industry has been fighting back quite aggressively, and I'm sure a lot of MPs have had extremely good dinners courtesy of the pensions industry. And one of the counterattacks the pensions industry did, the NAPF, National Association of Pension Funds or something like that, they did a study where they found that of the new pensions being launched, the average charge was 0.46%. So the message is to politicians, well, why would you want to cap it at 1%? We're only charging 0.46, so hey, you know, everything's fine, leave us alone. God knows how they got to the 0.46%. Possibly they were including SIPs, I don't know, but that number I would take with a big pinch of salt. Anyway, the other problem with pensions is because we are paying so much in fees over such a long time, it's ludicrous. It's to pay that amount of money. The only thing that can work, well, all right, so I was going to move on to SIP, sorry. So a lot of people have realized, aha, I'm going to be smart, old-fashioned pensions, no good, cost a lot, don't perform, waste of time. I'll put my money in a SIP, 0.3 to 0.5%. Absolutely brilliant, well done. Good, they got the right answer. But then if they're with Hargreaves Lansdown, they'll get bombarded with material about the Hargreaves Lansdown Wealth 150 funds, the funds that are really going to grow your money. Or if they're with Fidelity, it'll be the Fidelity Select List. So they'll get this information about funds, and they'll put their money into a fund where they're paying 2%. So if you're paying 2% for your fund and 0.5% for your platform, you know, 2.5% times 40 years, it's a joke. It seems to me the only thing you should do is use a SIP, but put your money for the first 20 years of your working life at least into blue chip shares. After that, you can choose funds, but to do that before is ridiculous. And also, before the retail distribution review came into effect, there was a flurry of switch and get rich, where the pension fund manager, no, the IFAs were encouraging people to move their pensions so that they could get the big cut of the fees. And a lot of people lost a lot of benefits because the older pensions often had guaranteed annuity rates and other bits and pieces. Anyway, you've saved up. I've got two more little bits to go. I'm going to save 5 more minutes. You've saved up all your life. And 6 months before you retire or so, you get a nice big pack either from your pension fund manager or from your financial advisor saying what you need to do now is to buy an annuity. You get the peace of mind, the security of a fixed income for the rest of your life. And although with the bad publicity they've been having, annuity sales are falling, still about 335,000 of the 400,000 people or so people a year who can buy annuities are buying them. Three problems with the annuities. Number one, the one that's been in the news a lot over the last few weeks, OMO, the open market option. About 85% of people would be better off buying their annuity from a company other than the one that has their pension savings. Only 40% do so. So something horrible is happening there. Number two, enhanced annuities. There's a long list of medical conditions, and if you're lucky enough to have a few of those, you qualify for an enhanced annuity. Because your pension company, your annuity company, thinks you're going to pop your clogs earlier than someone who's a bit healthier. and reckoned 65% of people should be qualifying for enhanced annuities, and only 24% are actually getting them. So something going wrong there. But there's a deeper problem. There's a deeper problem. There's a logical inconsistency between the sales message, buy an annuity early, and the way that enhanced annuities work. Because if you are quite healthy at 65, by the time you're 70 or 75, you can bet your bottom dollar you're going to be able to tick off a few on the list. And, you know, if your legs dropped off or if you get high blood pressure, we see Miliband and Balls move into number 10 in 2015, then you can't go back to your annuity company and say, can I have more of my money? Because it's not your money. You gave it to them. It's their money now. And, of course, if you do pop your clogs, that's it. The annuity company will have a party and your heirs will be quite sad. And finally, you've saved up for your pension. You've got less than you expected. The annuity rates are dismal. But do not fear. The financial services industry can turn your golden years into the golden time of your life through an equity release loan. Now, the average equity... I've been to a couple of so-called retirement planning seminars, and all they are equity release salesmen trying to sell stuff. And it is incredible. At the end, virtually everybody in the room queues up to set an appointment for the equity release salesperson to visit them in their home to sell them an equity release loan. Now, the average equity release loan is 53,000. If you take that out at 65, by the time you're 85, when you might want to move to a care home or buy a retirement flat or whatever, you're going to owe around 200,000. Because the rule of thumb with equity release is doubles every 11 or 12 years. Conversely, if your children were to add that 53,000 to the mortgage, over the 20 years, they'd pay the whole lot back, about 75,000. So your family as a whole would be over £100,000 better off over 20 years, £5,000 a year. Now, of course, not every family can do that, but I suspect it's something that the equity release salesman doesn't mention when he visits. And the other thing about equity release is I get the feeling that people taking out equity release is a bit like them going to a sex shop. They sort of don't really want anyone to see them. And many parents are embarrassed about taking out equity release and they don't tell their children what they're up to. And there is horror and consternation in the family when they find out, my God, my parents have just, their whole house is gone, basically, all their assets. So that it is deeply troubling that I went to a presentation by Terry Smith of Fundsmith a few weeks ago. And, of course, you know, Fundsmith, they do their funds at a little percentage less than the average person. Yep. And he said the human brain cannot comp the effect of a small difference in interest rates over a long period of time. Right. So that's why I believe that for the average saver, the arguments they are given are logical, plausible, but highly misleading, often based on lies, and absolutely not in their interest. If this presentation could be a longer version of this presentation, a bit more detail, could be of interest to anybody in the companies you work in or the professional bodies you belong to or your clients or societies you belong to or whatever, please get in touch and I'd be happy to arrange something. Right, question time.